I'm an alcoholic and an addict. My name is Sherry. I am from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, born and raised there. My sobriety date is July 24th, 1997. Yeah. I do celebrate that with a lot of humility. I have a lot to tell you. Oh, here, I have a cheat sheet. Anything I do is not original. That I saw somebody else do that. I've never spoken with one, but you know, there's always that thing after you speak, like, damn, I wish I would have said that. So, but I do have a God, so I'm going to trust that anything I need to say, I'll say, and anything I need to leave out, I'll leave out. I want to thank the committee. Mark, Digby have been my contact. Mark, you were just the sweetest man. I just adore you. I met them at the Miami Roundup, and I'm on the programming committee for that, and we started talking, and he said, do you have a tape? I said, I do, and that's how I came to be here. I also want to thank my posse from Fort Lauderdale. I have... two people I sponsor are with me, and a dear friend, a black belt Al-Anon of 27, 8, 9 years, I don't know, Bucky Motter, and a dear friend from Denver, now Palm Springs, but we met in Denver, Jim. Thank you for coming to support me. That's important. I have fantastic friends today. I have amazing, amazing friends today. And that is all because of Alcoholics Anonymous. Can everybody hear me? Am I talking into the mic okay? Is that okay? It's really bright out there. I want to tell you a little bit about me, but first I want, somebody said, you know, start with a joke. Not very good at jokes. So, I have one, though, that I heard in a meeting, because everything I know, I heard in a meeting. And it goes like this, and it's about, and it's really, we've been doing the steps as a group together, and we just got done with the third step. We're on our fourth step on a trip together, you know, resentments. Wah! So, but the third step joke goes like this here. Now, think of me as a mountain biker, and I'm biking up a cliff, and I'm going up that cliff, and I'm just looking at all the beauty around me, just checking it out. And I'm so entranced with the beauty that I just go right off the cliff. So on my way down, the bike falls away. I'm just kind of floating down, and I grab a branch. And I'm on this branch, and I'm thinking, what the hell am I going to do now? They didn't prepare me for this. So I start thinking, well, I could ask God for help. That's what they said you should do if you get in a situation. So what I did was I look up. Now I'm a newcomer. Got to put that in there. And I say, God, is there a God? If there's a God, please show yourself. Nothing. I get nothing. The branch is starting to bend. My fingers are starting to slip. God, if there's a God, please help me. The clouds part. A voice says, let go of the branch. I think about this for a minute, and I think, is there anybody else up there? That's my third step joke. So, that's what it looked like for me when I started in recovery, was really, you want me to do that? So, and how I got there, how I got to that statement. I started drinking and using very young. I come from a family that are all self-made. They work their asses off to get what they have. And my dad did a very good job. He was a genius. He built a submersible pump, and, you know, he made an amazing business for himself and my mother. My mother was a huge part of that. He couldn't have done it without her. But in the meantime, there was a couple of kids running around without any direction because they were very busy working. And if you asked my brother and you asked me what happened in that household, you get two totally different answers. For me, as an alcoholic, that I think I was just born that way, as Lady Gaga says, I think that I just had that filter, you know, and I became a loner. And it wasn't that I wasn't smart and I wasn't likable and I wasn't cute and I wasn't, you know, I just really withdrew and kept my feelings to myself. And at 13, my brother had to take me to some kind of teenage party thing. He was 3 years older than me. And what happened was is that there was a bunch of teenagers down at the end of the driveway smoking pot. And I thought, wow, I want to do that. They are cool. And so the next day, I got my friend, and she stole some pot from her big brother, and we went to the stables. I had a horse and all that stuff growing up, and we went to the stables and we smoked a joint. Now, I know that some people, they get high or they drink. They don't always say, I love this and this is great. But for me, it was what I wanted to do the rest of my life. All those feelings that I had and all that aloneness that I had, gone. I became likable, I became pretty, I was funny, I was brave. That was one for me. That was what happened for me. I would do anything. Do not dare me, because I will do it. I don't care if it hurts, I'll do it. Because I didn't want to lose face. So I smoked pot every day that I can remember, unless I was forced somehow, some way, institutionalized. That was my choice. That's what I wanted to do. And that was my disease. It took care of all those feelings. So the first time I ever drank, I shotgunned a beer. Does anybody know what that is? And I mean, I didn't just go drink a beer. I had to shake it up and put a hole in it, and I don't know. So that was... Well, how could you get high the highest? Thanks for that. Putting those lights down. Those were my first of using. But I got to tell you, the minute I started getting high, I started stealing pills out of medicine cabinets, and I became a delinquent. My grades went straight down. We lived on 10 acres in the middle of nowhere, and so I would, it was the 70s, and I would hitchhike places, and at 14, going on 15, I had my first drink of Southern Comfort. Yeah. That's how I felt. And the next day, I went out and got the town drunk to buy me a bottle, a pint. And I sat at the Burger King with a courtesy cup of Coca-Cola and Southern Comfort. That's how I drank. And needless to say, my parents weren't looking. And I drank and stole from them. And also, you know, I never felt liked by people. I never felt like I belonged. And when I was going to school, I would steal money from my parents, and I would buy everybody at the bus stop candy, you know, because I wanted them to like me, you know. I really didn't feel like I had anything to offer. And that feeling followed me into recovery, that I don't belong followed me. Although this was my home, and I'll get to that, but there was still that I'm not worthy, I'm not good enough. And I drank to hide those feelings. I dropped out of school in ninth grade. I ran away from home, and one night I was doing drugs and drinking, and met these bikers in a bar, and they came home. I had an older boyfriend. He was 20-something, and they came to our house, and we got high all night, and when we left, they were going to their clubhouse, and my boyfriend and I thought we better follow them because they're really high. Like, we're not, but they're really high. So we followed them, and actually one got hit by a car, so on their bike, and we stopped and we helped them, and it was right down the street from the clubhouse. Well, that was my induction into the Florida Outlaws. I met the best bunch of people I thought I'd ever meet. And they were the coolest, you know, and I am a bit of a danger junkie. I like to be pushed to the edge of, like, daring. And I thought I had arrived. I mean, there were Harley Davidsons everywhere. They had a bar lined with booze. Drugs were free-flowing. I was in heaven. I left home for good about then. My mother did try to bribe them and tell them that she knows that I'm with them and that if anything were to happen, she knows who they are. So my mother had rescued me, tried to rescue me from myself for years. My mother never let me go hungry. She never let me go with dirty clothes. She always bought me clothes. There were times I would go hide out in her house, my dad not knowing I was there, and she would feed me and clothe me, and I'd feel better, and then I'd leave. And she did that for years. I stayed with the Outlaws for a while. The guy that I was with was murdered, and I became kind of a free floater around. Now, it wasn't as glamorous as my teenage kid would like you to think how cool I am. The truth is that I had to prostitute, dance in bars, and I got beat up on a regular basis. And the other truth is that I didn't know I was really wanted to be one of the guys. That didn't come yet. I wanted to be one of them. But that was not anywhere in my wheelhouse yet. And I continued to drink. I weighed all of 110 pounds. And at one point, somebody put a gun to my head and said, "What are you going to do if I pull this trigger?" And this is where I know that I've been carried for a long time. And what came out of my mouth was not the fear that I really felt. It was, "I guess it's going to be messy." And he said that was a good answer, and he walked away. And again, not my words. So I, at about 18, I got arrested. Now, I'd been arrested before, but I was juvie, so they let you go. But I turned 18. 3 months after I was 18, bam, arrested. And I spent some time in jail, just a few weeks, but long enough for me to get my GED. So I was productive. I was bored, and so I got my GED. It says North Point High School on it. I don't know where that is. And when I got out, I tried to, you know, go straight and not use. And I lived at my parents', and it lasted all of a couple months. I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. I wanted to use more than I wanted to be good, because then I was told I was bad trying to be good. So, and I couldn't be good. I was a bad girl. That's the way I like to live. And so I got out of there, and this one guy was trying to chase me down and kill me, so I jumped on I was dancing in a bar, and I met this girl, and her boyfriend lived on a bus, and they lived at a nudist camp. So I thought, I haven't done that. So I did it. I got on this bus with them and lived at this nudist camp. And then we went to Tampa, across the alley. Now, I'm on probation, not supposed to leave, not supposed to use either, but minor technicality. So I went over to Tampa with them. But what happened very quickly is that I wasn't pulling my weight, because I don't pull my weight. When I use, I'm a taker. I take anything I can, and I do it with a smile on my face. I am manipulating you the whole way. Anything that came out of my mouth was probably made up, a lie, or I heard from somebody else. And they figured that out really quickly. And I think they wanted to have a threesome, and he grossed me out, so that wasn't happening. So I got kicked out. And I stayed with this guy I met at the bar, and he kicked me out. I'd called my mother, and I wanted help. She said no. She had never said no to me before. And I don't know, I had a connection from somebody, and this guy had a van. He had a Ford Econoline van, and it was a 69 Ford Econoline. And it didn't run, but it was sitting in a campground, and it had a bed in the back. What more do you need? Seriously. So I bought it for $100 and a pair of cowboy boots. And that's where I lived for about 2 months. And I danced at the topless bar, and I drank Jack Daniels, and I did Valium. That was my cocktail. And one night, the cocktail went wrong, and and I wound up ODing while I was dancing, and I think I was at the naked part. So, girl down. So, legs in the air, I'm sure, I don't know. I mean, when I was drunk, I didn't care. I'd show you anything. My clothes came off so quick. Anyway, I woke up in ICU, and I just kind of came to a little bit, and I heard them asking me questions, and I was able to give them my mother's phone number, and then I was out again. And then I woke up in a regular room, and the first thing I did was pull out my IV and take off. And they left my clothes there. I mean, I had to. They set me up for that. So, and I made it to the campground where I got a hot Budweiser, sat on the park bench, and a cop rolled through. And I still had on the armband, so I couldn't lie when he asked me who I was. And he arrested me for violation of probation. And what I didn't know is that my mom had told them, you know, she has violated her probation in more ways than one, and that you should probably go pick her up. She's staying at this campground. And she saved my life. Oh, I didn't tell you, I cry. I'm a crier today. She really saved my life. He picked me up. I went into this jail. Now, I think it was new, because there was nobody in there. And it was kind of weird, because it was very clean and shiny and cold. And I laid down on that steel bunk, and the cop came over, and he said, "Are you hungry?" I couldn't remember the last time I had eaten. Those basic things that we do for ourselves, I had quit doing. And he brought me I don't know what it was, I think it was a bologna sandwich and a cup of red punch, and it was a point in my life. But I didn't have any solutions, so I didn't know what and where to go from here. But the county had a good idea. because I wasn't really going to be given any choices about that. So I wound up being transferred back over to Broward County, and I stayed there for 4 months. And I kept going in front of the judge, and the judge would say, she's not ready, and they'd send me back. And I didn't know, what am I ready for? So finally, and if you've ever been to jail, and then there's a detention center, and then they truck you in, it's an all-day affair. I have things to do. I'm going to miss something back at the jail. So I would always be annoyed because it's 6 in the morning, you're locked to somebody you don't know, and usually somebody you don't like. And so finally, the last time I went in front of that judge, he says, you're nothing but a little princess. Do you see your mother over there? She's here every time. She's growing old watching you die. You know when you hear the truth and it just like hits you in the gut. I knew, and I started crying, and he said, you are gonna die. You need help. This is 1983. He says, you need help. You need to go to an AA meeting. There's AA meetings in jail. I suggest you go to one. I don't wanna see you again until you've been to one. So I was, you know, bawling, but I didn't know that that was a turning point in my life. And I went back to the jail, and I heard there was a call for an AA meeting, and so I went to that AA meeting, and I sat down. The girl introduced the speaker. I don't know her name today. I don't know what she said, but I cried that whole meeting. I knew I had what she had. And I knew that there was no other life for me outside of this jail besides death. And that if I didn't get whatever she had, I was gonna die. But in my head is that the only thing I had to go back to were the outlaws. And that's the only life I knew. So about 3 weeks later, I get a call. Come out and get my stuff. I'm leaving. I'm like, no, I'm going to stay. I think I'm going to do 3 years at the prison, and I'm okay with that. And that's what it had come down to me. I was so scared to leave that jail because I didn't want to use, and I didn't think I could not use outside of those walls. And what I didn't know is that that judge got together with a community release officer, and they were both in AA. And they put me in a treatment center. And this is 1983, and the Young People's Movement was in full gear, and young people were starting to get sober in AA. And I got to be one of them. And I stayed sober for 10 years. And in that 10 years, I was a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a sponsor, and I sponsored people, and I went to conventions, and I chaired meetings, and I worked the steps, and I took institution meetings in, and I showed up. I did all those things. I got married to a guy. 7 months later, I left him for a woman. And when I told him I was leaving him for a woman, he said, I knew you were a dyke. Like, wow, why didn't you tell me? I wouldn't have to pay $20,000 for a wedding. So, but he thought, because I had a lot of sexual abuse in my past, and he thought maybe if somebody was nice to you, that would be different. And I'm not gay because I have sexual abuse. That's not my story. And so I met this woman, and I fell in love. And how I met this woman is I worked in a treatment center. Back then, you didn't really need a qualification. You just needed to be sober. I don't suggest that, because I had no boundaries. I really had no boundaries. I had no business working in a treatment center. I was a detox counselor, and that's good that they didn't give me any other power. But I had no qualifications. I went to do my CAAP, and that's nice. But I was about 5 or 6 years sober when I started working in that treatment center. And if people are doing that, you have a call for that, I'm all for it. But for me, it wasn't a good fit because my boundaries weren't so great. I met this woman in there that kept coming through detox. Literally, that's not my girlfriend. She introduced me to the woman that I left. But I started sponsoring her, broke the rules. And the woman had actually been through detox and in the main area while I was on my honeymoon. So I don't know. That's, you know. So I didn't meet her until later. So this woman, Stacy, introduced me to my next lover, and her name was Sandy. And we wound up moving to Colorado. And my father had just died unexpectedly, right before I moved to Colorado. And had a heart attack and died. And I had a lot of unfinished daddy business. But we went ahead and left. We were together about 3 months after we got to Colorado and broke up. It was like one of those patches. I don't know about you. Relationships are still my worst subject. I still am learning how to be in one and keep myself. Back then, I was really not good at it. And so I got there, and I got some money after Dad died, and I bought myself a Harley Davidson. I took my power back. That's what I thought, you know? I'm no longer riding on the back of that thing. I'm going to drive it. So while I was there, I went to some meetings, and they didn't do it right. It was different. I didn't have the tolerance for it, so I started hanging out with this girl's motorcycle crew, and they were really great people. And they were really nice women. They were great women, and they knew I was sober, and they respected that, and that was great. But what they didn't know, that if I don't go to meetings, I'm probably going to relapse. And after 9 months of not going to meetings, I was at one of our functions, and a joint went around. And I had not planned to smoke that joint. I had not thought about smoking a joint. I smoked that joint. I lost 10 years and 9 months because I wasn't going to meetings. I don't know about you, but I got a little attitude about it. I don't need AA. I was young. I didn't know how to use properly. So I spent the next 3.5 years white-knuckling, trying to pretend like I knew what I was doing. And 6 months later, I'm drinking something called a buttery nipple because it's him. I'd watched other people do it, and, you know, that thing was in my head, and I'm a lesbian, and seemed like the next right thing to do to me. Sorry, really, I am sorry about that. I the people in Colorado knew me sober. So I really saw my disease flying ahead. During that time, I had invited my friend Stacy that kept relapsing to come visit me in Colorado, and she got there, and she started smoking crack, and that wasn't okay. That's not okay. You gotta go. So I sent her on her way, and I wound up moving to Atlanta. And that's gonna be the right place to go and not use. And I got there, and I got a decent job, and I managed a coffee house, and I drank, and I smoked pot. And I did it like this, and then one day somebody sent some cocaine around. Exactly. And in 6 months, I was back in Florida. I'd lost my job, and that woman, Stacy, that kept relapsing that I knew, was at my house, and I said I had some cocaine, and she said, "Great, I have some needles." And I said, "Oh, I never done that before." And I still had the crack thing, not doing crack. But I'll put a needle in my arm. You know, when you say this shit out loud, it makes no sense. So that's what I did, and I fell in love. I fell in love. I found that the right amount of alcohol and the right amount of cocaine was what I sought. And I couldn't work. I couldn't hold a job. I was one of those addicts and alcoholics that I can't hold a job down. So I found myself laying on the bathroom floor with a needle in my arm, floating above myself and thinking, what have I done? Why am I here? How did this happen? I had 10 years of really good sobriety, or at least 9. That's God keeping me honest. And so I decided I'd go back to treatment, and my friend Sandy, my ex, who we stayed close and very much loved and respected each other, but we were using together. She started getting high later. We all used together, Stacy, Sandy. It was a mess waiting to explode. It was not pretty. But she put me in that treatment center, and I was there 48 hours, and I forgot my desperation. I got there and I went, I had 10 years. I know how this works. I don't need your help. Well, guess what? I got out and I started drinking. I stayed with my mother. I was drinking everything she had. I started shooting up again. I started hanging out with them, and it got really crazy. And I went out and, I've been smoking crack by now. Yeah. 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 The yet. So I went out one day and one morning, it's like 7 in the morning, and I went and I got a crack rock, and I stopped at the 7-Eleven for a 6-pack of Rolling Rock. And it's like by the courthouse, and everybody's got suits on, and they're all cleaned up, and they're getting a cup of coffee, and I'm like skeeving out, and you know, I just need my Rolling Rock. And I get home, and I melt that down and put it in my arm, and it's not really that great. And then there was nothing. I have a choice at this point. I can go prostitute, which I have not done yet. I have not done since I was 20 years old, 21 years old. And at this point, I'm like 35. Or I can get sober. Neither one of those sounded like very good prospects to me. And it's that point, you know, when I asked God for help. God, if there is a God, please help. That's what happens on my door. I swear, 10 minutes. And it's my, okay, lesbians. It's my ex's ex that lives with her. And they have a business together. But she's using as hard as I am, and this woman, Deb, is not an addict. She's just not an addict. She doesn't get it. And she says, I've had the most respect for you. And, you know, I think that maybe you should come with me and try and get clean. And I heard it. I heard God calling. And I said, okay. What I didn't know was that we were moving to a place near Gainesville in the swamp. That's what Gainesville is, by the way. It's like the swamp. And we went there, and what I found out is that I was going to be staying with her mom and dad in a trailer, single-wide trailer. Oh, and they're born-again Christians. So I have all these preconceived notions about that, and I have a lot of opinions about it. And but it's too late to turn back now. So I have a bag of pot, and I'm still drinking. But I've put the needles down and the cocaine down, and I'm in the middle of the swamp. And I'm with these people, and I think, this is going to be hell. This is going to be terrible. I'm starting to plot how to get out of here. But what happened was not what I thought would happen. What happened was they never asked any questions. They fed me. They included me. They were loving. They were kind. They were really amazing people and very gentle and very loving. So I got a little healthier. I was still smoking some pot. I wasn't drinking that much, and I was starting to feel good, and Deb and I went over to St. Augustine, and we got a house, and we set up house, and now we're lovers. And you saw that coming, though, right? So we're lovers, and, you know, it's going pretty good. And I'm thinking I can do this thing. I'm having a little hard time with work, though. It's really hard to, like, look people in the eye. I really didn't feel good about myself. And what happened next changed my life. I got a phone call from my sponsor, Amy, who is one of my closest and dearest friends today. She's sober like 32 years, and she was my sponsor during those first 10 years. And she was my mentor, my brother, my sister, my father, my mother. She was everything to me. She taught me how to live. She just grew me up in AA. I got a call from her, and she was very close with Sandy, my ex, and they were like two 10-year-olds together. It was a really amazing friendship. And what I got was that Sandy killed Stacy, shot her in the head, a little cocaine paranoia, and pushed her out of a car, and it was a big moment for me. Now, I should have gotten sober. I spent about a month in shock. I went out, and I got drunk one night, and I was silly drunk. It was not anything spectacular. It wasn't anything profound. It was drunk and remorseful and regretful. It was miserable. I woke up the next morning and I said, God, please. That's it. I haven't had a drink or a drug since. What I know about Alcoholics Anonymous is that death, institutions, and there's another one, we can live, we can get sober. And I knew that Stacy's dead. Sandy's in prison, and she's still in prison today. By the way, I see her about once a month. Or I can get sober and honor them and take my life back. That meant I needed to go to meetings. I had a resentment. I didn't want to go to your fucking meetings. And so I didn't. I went to about a half a dozen in 3 years. I got hepatitis C while I was out there. I went into the meeting. I went to work one day, and Deb had told this guy who's in the program, "I'm really worried about her. I think she's depressed. I'm afraid she might drink." At that time, I'm 3 years sober, dry drunk, and he leaves me a note on my desk, and I still have that note today, and it says, "Be ready by 7 o'clock. I'm picking you up, and you're going to the Queen City meeting with me." And I went to that meeting, and I realized I am home. This is my home. I had been depriving myself and punishing myself for losing 10 years. I had to let that go and start living now. So, unfortunately for Deb, I left her. I wasn't happy in that relationship, but I knew that, so I stayed. And I left her, and I moved back to Fort Lauderdale to my people. And I started to live this life beyond my wildest dreams. I started to thrive again in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was enfolded and loved back to life. Now, I want to tell you, in that time, since I got sober and now, there's been some bumps in the road for me. There's been depression. At 11 years sober, I picked up my medallion crying, hating life, and I wanted to die. You loved me. You held me. You told me this too shall pass. And Jeffrey V, I don't know if anybody knows him. He's pretty famous. He's a bit of a drag queen, and he, and a drama queen. But that man wrapped his arms around me and said, "You are a precious child of God, and you deserve to be here." So I had some work to do, and I did some work, and I sought some outside help, and I also got a great sponsor. You know, I was sitting in a meeting one day, and a, guy came in and he sat down. There was a couch. It was like a U-shaped couch thing, and then some chairs. And he's sitting over there, and I'm got my buddy over here, and we're kind of talking in the meeting. You know, you're not supposed to do that, but we were doing it. And he says, "Shh, I'm trying to have a meeting." Really? He reeked of alcohol. And I'm like, "Ugh, God, this reeks of alcohol." So I say to my sponsor after the meeting, "That guy reeks of alcohol." And she went, "Oh my God, there's a drunk in a meeting." Okay. Back down to earth. That same sponsor, Lois is her name, she's big in Al-Anon. I say to her, "You know, that meeting kind of sucked. God, what was I thinking?" You don't say that to your sponsor. She said, "Really? Maybe the meeting wasn't for you today. Maybe your job was just to sit in the seat. And it was for somebody else." Oh. I don't complain at all anymore. And, well, I do, but it, you know, it doesn't come out there. I have friends and a life that I would trade for nothing. I have a family. Now, my brother, that same brother I talked about, he's an alcoholic, but, you know, he's also a millionaire, so it's, like, kind of hard to see. So, and I know you're not supposed to say anybody else is an alcoholic, but he's my brother, so I'm going to say it. I love him. And today I see his pain, and I have compassion for him. And I learned that because I used to watch people pick up white chips, and I would get so impatient. I'd be like, what's their fucking problem? Don't they just get it already? God, how many do you have to have? And one day this woman picked up your medallion after I had been saying that about her. And it hit me. You're supposed to have as many as you're fucking supposed to have. The only person counting are people like you, and you're an idiot. So I know that when we're supposed to get it, we get it. And those people who need to pick up white chips, as long as we keep these rooms open and they have a place to come pick them up, that's our job. A few years ago, and I'm going to close shortly, I was introduced to some people, and I started to learn how to meditate and pray, and I found a God of my own understanding. For years, I've been parroting, "You're God." You know, you say this is what God is. Okay, that's what God is. You know, I don't know, I don't get it. I'm not hearing things. I see miracles. I see that, but it's still really uncomfortable for me to grasp. And a few years ago, I had a spiritual awakening, and it went kind of like this. I'm quiet, and I'm listening, and I realize I am whole today. I am no longer walking around feeling broken. I do on occasion, because I'm human, and I feel like I don't get shit, and the relationship stuff's hard, and all that, but I know today I'm whole. And that was a direct message. I don't even know how to tell you. But I was able to start to have my own spiritual understanding and my own connection. It's not yours, it's mine. And so, you know, there's a lot I didn't tell you. And I think I'm about ready to close. So what I do want to tell you is that I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I stay in service to Alcoholics Anonymous because it's a trick I have to play on my disease. Because my disease will tell me to stay home alone and don't answer the phone. And so I do, I've been working with the Roundup in Miami for 8 years, and I stay connected. I take a position on that on a committee somewhere, so I have to show up and be accountable to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to tell you a little bit about that third step joke. The truth is that when I let go of the branch, I never have far to fall, because you guys are always there to catch me. Thank you.
This recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.